This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montagne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. British Prime Minister Tony Blair was at his country's embassy in Washington yesterday. He took off his jacket and strolled outside. He paced a green lawn, talking with his chief of staff, the way you'd expect a prime minister to do in a movie. In Tony Blair's case, the movie is almost over. He's on his way out of office. And when he came in off the lawn, he sat down to talk about it. After a decade in power, Blair is unpopular in his country. That's partly because of his support for the president, who just had him stay over at the White House the night before, and especially because of his support for the war in Iraq.
Have you noticed opportunities being missed, where you just don't have the resources, the political capital, the troops, to do what you want to do elsewhere in the world?
No, I haven't noticed that, but I have noticed that there's been a fall in the confidence that in your country and in my country there has been in what we're doing in Iraq. And at the moment, we're in a very fragile situation with our opinion. And that's where you've got just very carefully to analyze what is actually happening there in order to see what you should be doing.
Help me out there a little bit, because people have heard your defenses of the war. People have heard President Bush's defenses of the war. And many people, nevertheless, have grown tired of the war, turned against the war.
Of course.
What is it that you know that nobody else knows?
I don't think it's that I know anything that nobody else knows. But it's a question of, look, the reason why people in Britain, people in America, have lost patience to an extent is because they see the carnage and the bloodshed going on. And they say, this is now 4 years after the fall of Saddam. So if that is still happening, that must mean that the thing is wrong. And the truth of the matter is, it is being driven largely by Al-Qaeda on the one hand, Iranian-backed elements on the other hand, who are linking up with a minority of extremists inside Iraq in order to do maximum damage so that people do lose faith.
I want to ask again about missed opportunities, and I want to stipulate that you feel that on balance it's better to be in Iraq than not.
But certainly better than if Saddam and his two sons were still running Iraq, because in my view, we'd just have a stack of different problems.
But as you look over the last several years, haven't there been occasions when you've had to say to yourself, I might have been able to make progress on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, but Iraq is in the way, drains energy, drains credibility. Or are there any number of issues where you just did not have the time or the capital to deal with them?
I don't, you know, if you take the Palestinian issue, the reason why there's not, you know, the reason why there isn't progress in Palestine in the way there should be, it's because the same forces are at work. Look, there's absolutely no doubt at all that you could get a Middle East peace process that would deliver an independent, viable Palestinian state and an Israel confident of its security, living side by side in peace. The reason you can't is that every time we get anywhere near progress, the same terrorism erupts.
Well, there was a time that people hoped, perhaps you hoped, that the war in Iraq would make it easier to achieve peace between Israelis and Palestinians. Perhaps it's ended up being the opposite.
I don't think it's been the opposite, but I think that if you are able to make progress in Iraq, it will help enormously the forces of progress everywhere in the Middle East, which of course is why the forces of reaction are trying to stop us. This is a global movement founded on a perverted and warped view of Islam that is everywhere.
Which is able to send its people to Iraq to get trained and back out again.
Well, but they were able before that to send them to Afghanistan. Unfortunately, there are some of them being trained in Pakistan. They're being trained now in Africa. You see, if I have a criticism of our policy, if you like, the only way you are going to knock out this terrorism eventually is not just through the force of arms, but through the force of ideas. Freedom, yes, and democracy, yes, but also about justice, which is why progress on poverty in Africa matters, in my view. I think a deal on climate change matters, even for this broader picture. And the Middle East peace process matters.
Do you think that the Western world has been a little slower to come around to paying attention to an issue like climate change, which you've called the single most important issue we face, because of the distraction of the war? Has it been harder to get public attention?
No, I don't think it is, but I think there is an issue which we're trying to resolve now in the context of the G8 summit in the next few weeks, which is how do you get a climate change deal that involves China and India and the developing world, as well as America and Europe and Japan.
Why does China, for example, have to cut its emissions in order for you to cut your emissions in Britain?
Well, it doesn't, but the reality is, if we shut down the whole of Britain, nothing emitted, within 2 years, the growth in Chinese emissions would wipe out the difference we would make. That's the reason. China is almost at the same level of emission today as America, and within a few years will pass it. If you don't get China and India and America in this deal, you're not really where it's at, I'm afraid.
I want to ask another question about how your country has changed during your 10 years as prime minister. Is it a little harder now, maybe even a lot harder, to define who's British and what that means?
Well, I would like to say to that no, because I think we're very proud of the British values and we're proud of our history and we're proud of our traditions. But we're also proud of the fact that we have people of different races and cultures and faiths. I think immigration is one of the toughest issues for any modern democratic country. It causes tremendous problems and tensions, but at the same time, actually, migration for us has in many ways also strengthened our country and given it a dynamism and an energy that it needs.
And also raised questions about Islam versus Christianity versus anything else. Raised questions about homegrown terrorists in some cases.
Yeah, but you know, the way we defeat that is to bring people of different faiths together and let those sensible, moderate majority voices in Islam be heard. To go back a bit to what we were talking about before, but my view is you will never defeat this unless you don't just argue against the methods of these terrorists, but also their ideas and their presumed sense of grievance against the West. You've got to go right into the depths of their ideology and confront it head on if you want to defeat it, I think.
Will you be working on that issue after you leave office?
Well, I'd like to, yes. I mean, I would like to, because I think what is important is that we try to get a better understanding and better dialogue between people of different faiths. But I am interested in the interfaith ideas, and it's something that I think a lot about and would like to work on, but whether that's possible or not, I just don't know.
I want to ask about a couple of other things, Prime Minister. In your departure from office, was there something at the beginning that you thought, I'm going to be able to change the world in this way, and you discovered very quickly that you couldn't?
No, I don't think so. I don't leave disappointed in that sense at all. Actually, I'm still immensely optimistic about the world and the possibility of changing it. I think the interesting thing for me is, if you'd said when I came in 1997, what was the balance between domestic and foreign policy, I would have, you know, foreign policy was something in the bottom drawer. The nature of the world today, I mean, I'm convinced of this, that its defining characteristic is interdependence. And yet politics, both left and right, hasn't really quite worked out the implications of that yet.
Before you took office, you gave an interview in which you spoke about your father, who, as some people will know, ran for parliament and had a stroke, never was able to complete the campaign. You said that your father transferred his ambitions to his kids, and I felt I couldn't let him down. Have you gotten to the point where you think he'd be satisfied with you now?
Well, that's a very difficult question. And my dad's still alive. Well, I let him down in one sense, since he was a conservative, and I went the other way. But the single thing that my father did that made most difference to me in a way was that he was a guy from a poor background. He was a foster child. He believed that if you became successful, then you became conservative, and that the trouble with the Labour Party was that it always held you back. And I always kind of imported that notion.
You believed that part of it?
Well, the biggest change, I think, and I hope I made in the Labour Party, was to say that the Labour Party should be the marriage of aspiration and compassion, that there's nothing wrong with wanting the best for yourself and your family. It's just that you don't want to exclude that possibility for other families too.
And that was close enough to his beliefs to avoid any uncomfortable dinners?
No, there were a few, although, you know, being a good Tory, he was just pleased his boy had done well. And he then actually joined the Labour Party later, but I never quizzed him too carefully on whether he'd switched his beliefs or not, since I might have got some politically incorrect answers, I think.
Well, Prime Minister Blair, thanks very much.
Thank you.
You can read the full interview with Tony Blair at npr.org, where you can also find his views on a scandal of British tea.